Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back. Today, we're stepping a bit away from the everyday noise. We're going deep into something ancient, but also, I think, incredibly relevant right now. We're doing a deep dive into Say Nothing, Poems of Jalal al-Din Rumi.
And specifically, the translations by Iraj Anwar and Anne Twitty. This collection, well, it's much more than just beautiful poetry.
Right. It feels more like a roadmap, maybe a guide to spiritual transformation.
Exactly.
Okay.
For anyone seeking, anyone curious about what lies beyond the surface, it's powerful stuff.
So our goal today is to explore why this poet, you know, from the 13th century, still speaks so directly to us, especially with our modern feelings of, well, separation, maybe information overload, that constant search for something outside ourselves.
And Rumi's answer is just so radical and simple in a way.
Yeah.
But completely counterintuitive. That you can't think your way to the divine, to ultimate reality. Logic, language, they fall short.
You have to go beyond words.
Precisely. That's why the title Say Nothing isn't just a title. It's the core instruction. The real truth, he suggests, is found when the self, the ego, dissolves completely in, well, in what he calls divine love.
Okay, but before we get into the poems themselves, we really should talk about this specific translation. Because Rumi translations are, well, they're all over the place, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. You have the very academic ones, which can be quite dry. And then you have versions that are, frankly, pretty loose, maybe more commercialized.
So what makes this Anwar and Twitty collaboration different? Why is it like the key to unlocking Rumi's real fire?
It's about that balance. It's about capturing the fire without, you know, losing the original essence. Iraj Anwar. He brings the deep cultural grounding.
Native Iranian, steeped in Sufism.
Exactly. So he's the anchor. He makes sure the core philosophy, the specific cultural nuances, the metaphors, they remain authentic. He guards against it becoming just exotic or watered down for us.
And then Anne Twitty comes in, the American poet.
Yes, and her gift is taking that authentic core and shaping it into English verse that lives. She understands cadence, rhythm, the evocative power of the language. She makes Rumi's voice resonate across, what, 8 centuries?
So it's this faithful artistry. It avoids being just academic, but it also avoids being too simplistic, too feel good.
That's the magic, I think. It lets us encounter Rumi not as some distant historical figure, but as a vital, demanding spiritual guide, someone who asks for everything.
Okay, let's talk about that demand. This collection, Say Nothing, it isn't just random poems thrown together, is it? It feels like it has a structure, a journey.
It absolutely does. Its purpose is really to pull you past those surface-level Rumi quotes everyone knows.
The inspirational ones.
Right, and pull you into the deep end, into the challenging, sometimes shocking heart of Sufi mysticism. It's really for anyone who feels there has to be more than just the material world.
So the book intends to move you from where to where?
From the pain of feeling separate, disconnected, all the way to the ecstasy of realizing you were never separate at all.
And it starts with that pain, doesn't it? That deep sense of longing. Rumi uses the image of the reed flute, crying because it's been cut from the reed bed.
Yes, the soul's sorrow at separation. But crucially, Rumi says that pain, that longing, it's not a problem to be fixed.
It's not something to distract ourselves from.
No, he'd say it's sacred. That restlessness, that dissatisfaction we all feel sometimes, that's your soul's compass pointing home. It's the fuel you need for the journey.
Okay, fuel for the journey.
Yeah.
But where does the journey lead first? You mentioned a rather alarming place earlier, the Tavern of Ruin.
Ah, yes, the Tavern of Ruin. It sounds pretty confronting, doesn't it?
Oh,
especially if you're focused on, you know, stability, reputation.
Yeah, ruin isn't usually on the vision board.
Exactly. But that's the radical core of it. The tavern is metaphorical. It's the place where you have to be willing to let go of everything the ego holds dear. Reputation, social standing, intellectual pride, your fixed ideas about right and wrong, all of it. You have to trade sober certainty for what Rumi calls divine madness, spiritual intoxication.
So you have to be willing to essentially dismantle your identity to find what's real.
That's the path.
Yeah.
It leads towards fauna, annihilation, the idea that the individual drop has to dissolve into the vast ocean of the beloved of God.
Wow. So the separation we feel is the illusion, and the journey is this. intense, fiery process of dissolving the very self that believes in that separation.
You got it. And the driving force behind this entire difficult process, it's not reason, it's not willpower, it's Ishq.
Divine love.
Yes. But not gentle, comfortable love. Rumi presents Ishq as this overwhelming cosmic fire, demands absolute surrender. It's the only thing powerful enough to burn away the ego's grip and carry the soul back to its source.
Okay, let's dive a bit deeper into that structure you mentioned. The poems seem to move through distinct phases, mapping the Sufi path. Stage one is the cry of separation.
Right. This is where we face our spiritual amnesia, as some call it. We suffer because we've forgotten we're part of the divine whole. But Rumi frames this pain positively. It's not failure, it's the starting gun.
It's the signal, accepting that restlessness as a call, not a pathology.
Precisely. Which leads directly into stage two, the path of annihilation, fauna. And this is where it gets really challenging for our modern minds, right?
Because it directly attacks the rational mind. It says worldly knowledge, our cleverness, is actually an obstacle.
Exactly. Because the intellect, our cleverness, is the ego's primary tool. It analyzes, categorizes, judges. It maintains the separation. You can't analyze your way into unity.
You have to surrender to it.
You have to feel it, experience it, embrace the Tavern of Ruin instead of clinging to cautious piety. This is where Rumi's poetry gets really wild.
The imagery, yeah. Dancing until the self disappears.
Or the moth drawn to the candle flame. Knowing it means destruction, but it can't resist the light. That's the pool of Ishq.
And this stage often brings in Rumi's relationship with Shams of Tabriz, right? That intense, scandalous connection that completely upended Rumi's life as a respected scholar.
Yes. It's the ultimate real-life example. Letting love completely dismantle the identity you thought you had. That's fauna in action.
So you go through this fire, this annihilation. What comes next? Stage three, the ocean of union, Bakra.
This is the payoff, so to speak. It's the dawning realization of non-duality. The Sufi concept of Tawhid, the oneness of being.
The understanding that you were never actually separate.
Never. The small, finite self is lost, yes. But what awakens is the true self, the infinite divine identity that was always there, just veiled by the ego.
So if Baka, this union, is about peace and awe, why the continued emphasis on the fire, the madness of Ishq? Does the journey just stop?
That's a great question. The peace isn't static. It's not complacency. The fire of Ishq is still needed because the world, our habits, constantly try to pull us back into the illusion of separation.
Ah, okay. So the union is the realization, but staying awake to it requires that passionate energy?
Yes. You see the beloved's face everywhere, in every atom. The tone shifts maybe from desperate longing to this profound, ecstatic awe. But the energy, the love, is still fiercely alive.
Which brings us neatly to the final stage. Stage four, the language of silence. The title of the book, If Rumi Wrote So Much, Why Tell Us to Say Nothing? Seems paradoxical.
It is a paradox, but it's the ultimate pointer. Words, even his beautiful words, are just fingers pointing at the moon.
Once you've seen the moon.
Once you've tasted the union, the words just. They can't contain it. They become inadequate. The deepest conversation, the true communion with reality, happens in silence, in that wordless, heart-centered presence.
That shift from striving with the mind to just being present in the heart. That feels like the core transformation. Okay, let's try to distill this. What are, say, three absolutely essential takeaways from Rumi here?
Okay, number one, absolutely central. The primacy of divine love, Ishq. Forget intellectual paths. Forget just following rules. Love is the engine. It's this cosmic force demanding total surrender. It's the only way home.
Got it. Love first. Second.
Second, the necessity of annihilating the ego, fauna. The ego, the sense of a separate self, is the main obstacle. It's the veil. So the journey is this death before death.
I like that image. Rumi uses the chickpea being boiled. It has to suffer the heat to become soft, useful, delicious.
Exactly. The suffering transforms it. And third, Rumi's constant challenge to the inadequacy of intellect and dogma.
Right. Sell cleverness and buy bewilderment.
That's the one. Reason might get you to the door, he suggests, but only love can open it. He pushes you away from secondhand knowledge towards direct, lived experience. Bewilderment over certainty.
And these powerful ideas really stick because of how Anwar and Twitty render his lines. Let's share a few key quotes or concepts, that incredibly famous one. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and right doing, there is a field. I'll meet you there.
Ah, yes. Pure liberation, isn't it? It's like he's saying, just stop with the endless judgments, the dualistic thinking that chops reality up. True being exists in this open space beyond those limited categories. Pure acceptance.
And then there's the one that completely reframes the spiritual search. Your task is not to seek for love, but merely to seek and find all the barriers within yourself that you have built against it.
That turns everything inside out, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Love isn't something external you need to find or earn. It's your fundamental nature. The real work, Rumi says, is internal. It's dismantling the walls, the fear, the pride, the limiting beliefs we've built against our own innate connection and joy.
It's subtraction, not addition.
Precisely. And maybe one more, that beautiful paradoxical expression of Baka, of unity. I am a particle of dust in the sun's rays. I am the round sun. I am the mast, the rudder, the boatman, and the boat.
That just captures it. You aren't just the tiny part, the speck of dust. You realize you're also the whole thing, the sun, the boat, the journey itself. The seeker and the sought become one.
Okay, so we've journeyed through this mystical path.
Yeah.
But let's bring it down to earth a bit. Mm. What does Rumi's pretty radical perspective mean for you listening now in your daily life? What are the practical applications? Well, that instruction to say nothing, it's a powerful endorsement of mindfulness and presence, straight up. So much of our modern anxiety comes from the nonstop chatter in our heads, right?
The internal critic, the worrier.
Yeah. Reliving the past, rehearsing the future. Rumi guides us to find that field beyond right and wrong within us in the present moment. Practicing silence, even for short periods, can ground you, reduce that mental noise.
So silence isn't empty, it's full. It's presence. Okay, what about handling difficult times? Rumi insists pain is a gift. How do we actually apply the transformation of pain?
It's about reframing. When hardship hits, grief, failure, loss, instead of immediately trying to escape it or numb it, see it as Rumi's fire, the thing that softens the chickpea.
Allowing it to be there.
Allowing it, feeling it, trusting that the pain itself can carve out space within you for deeper wisdom, for compassion. Rumi wrote his most profound poetry out of the intense grief over losing Shams. Comfort rarely deepens us like hardship can, if we allow it.
Allowing pain to create space. I like that. Okay, one more. Fostering creativity. In our work, we're usually rewarded for being clever, analytical.
But Rumi flips that script. He'd say real breakthroughs, true creativity, often springs from bewilderment, not cleverness. From intuition, from being willing to enter a state of not knowing.
So if you're feeling stuck,
try surrendering the need to figure it all out. Embrace the uncertainty. Stop analyzing. Start listening to yourself, to the world around you. Trust that insights can emerge when you loosen the ego's grip on control.
What really hit home for me in this whole deep dive is that sense that spiritual awakening isn't about accumulating more knowledge in your head. It's an experience. It's a surrender of the heart.
Yes.
Fueled by this incredibly potent love that asks for, well, everything. The annihilation of the self to gain itself.
Absolutely. And I think the lasting insight, especially for today, is how Rumi's work acts as this powerful antidote. An antidote to the constant pressure, the anxiety, the feeling of not enough.
That longing we feel.
That longing, that anxiety. Rumi teaches us it's not a flaw in us. It's the sacred call of the soul itself. It's beckoning us away from the frantic external world of doing, doing, doing.
Towards the inner world.
Towards the quiet, spacious, internal world of simply being. And that's where the real treasure lies.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.